This is reality proves possibility. We can do better than this. Welcome, everyone. This is Reality Proves Possibility, and we can do better than this. And I'm honored to be here with Sandra Waddock, a pioneer in the field of responsible business, corporate citizenship, corporate responsibility, corporate social responsibility, transformation, many other fields. And Sandra, we have done this before in other contexts with the International Humanistic Management Association, but it's overdue that you and I speak directly. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for inviting me, Michael.
And my first question is just like, what's your reaction to reality proves possibility and we can do better than this?
So as I reflect on my whole career, I've always believed that we can do better than this, whatever this was going on at the time. I think as scholars, we all have a fundamental question we're trying to ask. And mine has always been, initially was, how do we get companies to sort of behave better, to be more responsible? And now that has morphed into how do we get the whole system to do that? And I don't know, we're facing a huge set of troubled times now. Currently in the United States where I am, chaos is the sort of operative word. And yet, I think in order to be able to go forward, you have to maintain hope in some way. So that's why I keep working, doing what I'm doing.
Great. So yeah, the standard premise is that we can do better than this and whatever this is, right? And so that there is a need for hope, almost a requirement for hope, but maybe also a seed that's nurtured through witnessing what's possible, right? And I think you've always written about that in many different ways. And maybe you can give us a little bit of a synopsis of your long, illustrious career, because in some way, yes, you have spawned many fields and contributed to many fields way ahead of many others. Sometimes your name is on that, sometimes not so much. But that, I think, is sort of the real sign of an intellectual leader in ways that the ideas are out there. And even if the name may not be attached, but I think that's important to honor that, too. So I thank you very much for doing that kind of work that you're doing, because you're giving permission to many others, even without knowing. And so if you could just walk us through your career, your process, and how you would see it right now, that'd be great.
Yeah, so I actually do hear from younger scholars that the ability to sort of span boundaries is really important to them, and to really, I always see my work as sort of on the edge of what's sort of acceptable at some points, which makes it hard to get published in quote unquote the mainstream journals. And I've stopped caring about that at this point in my career. But I started out studying public-private partnerships when no one knew what it was. But my committee, who consisted of Jim Post and Dave Brown, and a couple others, were systems thinkers right from the start. So they introduced me to the whole systems idea. And the idea was how was business engaging with public schools at the time in these partnerships, which no one had ever heard of. And so that sort of set me on this track of being on the edge of what people understand, I think. And I've always sort of liked being on that edge because that's where interesting ideas are. So for me, it's all about ideas. Mm. I kind of moved from public-private partnership, business involvement, schools, thinking about systemic approach to ensuring that K through 12 schools, kindergarten through 12th grade schools, could improve, and actually worked with a colleague at Boston College who actually has dramatically implemented that over the years. I don't know to what extent my work influenced her, but she has a great program that is really working on whole systems approach to making sure that kids get what they need in schools. Then I moved to thinking about sort of corporate responsibility more directly. I was lucky enough to know Steve Leidenberg, who was one of the founders of KLD, and he gave me the data, the KLD data, which are the current, still one of the foundations of looking at financial and social performance, with my colleague Sam Graves to publish one of the seminal papers, what became one of the seminal papers, the link between social and financial performance, with the idea in my head theory of change, if you will, that if you told the financial community and the business community that doing well enable them to do better financially, that everything would change. And, you know, of course, companies would behave better. Well, you know, almost 30 some years later, not so much. So, you know, recognizing that and recognizing that corporate social responsibility, which I, and citizenship, corporate citizenship, which I also studied for a long period of time, on a voluntary basis, was only partially getting us to where we wanted. It was not going to make this kind of systemic change that was needed. I began sort of broadening out that question a little bit. And so at one point, I realized that I knew a lot of folks who were creating what I ended up calling a corporate responsibility infrastructure, a set of institutions that was really meant to hold companies more responsible and accountable for their impacts, particularly the negative impacts that they had. And I wrote a book called The Difference Makers for the around these amazing people. And then later on, I broadened that to academics who were also on the boundary of what was known and who were, you know, carving their own pathways and in ways that most academics simply don't do. I just interviewed a bunch of people that I admired and found out why and what the commonalities among them were, ended up calling these folks intellectual shamans, because I had also started a practice with a teacher on sort of a modern version of shamanism in our culture. And shaman is a healing practice, and the whole idea behind everything I've ever done is to heal the world in some way. So as scholars, I think we have questions that drive us, and mine was always how do you get companies to be more responsible, and that has morphed in the last 10 years or so to how do you get the whole system to be better for everyone. So in more recent times, I've been working on this idea of catalyzing transformation, which I think is what is actually needed, because these tinkering around the margins kinds of change aren't going to change business. Business responds rightly to the pressures in the system that it's in. And right now, the pressures are all around financial performance. Until you change those pressures to something like creating better well-being for everyone and change the purpose of business, you're not going to get there. So I've been working on this whole notion of catalyzing transformation in the past few years. Just finished, one of the big things I did for the last 3 years was worked with an intergovernmental panel on biodiversity, the equivalent of the IPCC, and it was on transformative system change. And so that is about to be released. The summary for policymakers is already available. And, you know, cast of 100 scientists from around the world, with a few sprinkled in social scientists like me, amazing people who get the need for change and who understand how to think about it in ways that I am not convinced management scholars yet understand. Despite our supposed emphasis on things like organization development and change, it's very much focused at the individual company level. It's not necessarily systemic in its orientation. That's sort of where I am now.
What gives you hope right now?
What gives me hope? Well, actually, these ideas are being adopted in various places, which I think is really fun, and that the idea of catalysis is coming up in various places. What gives me, I mean, I think you have to have a basis of hope. I see a lot of initiatives sort of at the ground level, communities that are trying to bring about these kinds of changes and hoping that sort of filters up. I see people like you starting initiatives like the Humanistic Management Group to really change the story and the narratives that we tell ourselves as scholars. I don't see all of those initiatives penetrating sufficiently yet into the sort of mainstream. And what strikes me about that is how sort of unopen to becoming more aware of the systemic impacts of things many people are. But I think that we have to keep trying or else.
But you see things happening that actually give you reason to continue and move forward, because I think that's always how it has worked, right?
Yeah. I mean, was it Margaret Mead said, never doubt the capacity of a small group of people to make a big change, and something along those lines. And, you know, that is what is happening. And in wherever I go, within even within the Academy of Management, our sort of our broad, our professional organization, the people of the sessions I go to that I'm interested in are the ones where people are going, we need to do something different. We need to change. Mm-hmm. And young scholars like that, there's a group called the Impact Scholars, young mm-hmm. scholars getting together, trying to really make a difference. Mm-hmm. You go to these doctoral consortia and all of the younger scholars are like, I don't want to do trivial research. I want to make something mm-hmm. It makes a difference. And they're kind of suppressed by a very dominant system that asks them not to do that. Mm-hmm. But many of them have this sort of power inside of them that they're going to do it anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, so there are these seeds of things all over the place, mm-hmm. you know, that you can't necessarily put your finger on. Now, the catalyzing idea is bringing them together. Because that's where the power lies, because we need to shift the main narrative, which is still neoliberal economics right now. Mm-hmm. And without shifting that, the stories we tell ourselves stay in the old way. And if you look at management education, it's totally infused with neoliberalism. We indoctrinate our students with it. And so they get to someone like you or me in a course, and we're saying, no, it's not like that. It really, and it can't be like that. It's a normative kind of thing, right? And they're like, well, but the other 18 courses, 17 courses that we took, that was, it is like this.
So what do you see? I mean, you say basically what's missing is bringing these sprouting seeds potentially, or these dormant seeds, to fruition, but maybe in concert, right? So like not just single flowers everywhere, but maybe a garden.
You have to propagate change. Mm-hmm. You can't scale change. I don't, because mm-hmm. each system, each context is unique. But if you could bring them together to cohere, so I talk mm-hmm. about connecting, that's the bringing them mm-hmm. together. Hearing, which is the aspirations and the shared narratives. Then amplifying, so connecting, cohering, and amplifying as the catalytic process. It means, you know, humanistic management group, for instance, is going to go and do what it does. Mm-hmm. But it's also going to align maybe with this new initiative that Stuart Hart is developing called internality. Mm-hmm. It's maybe going to align with the principles for responsible management education. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's in that alignment process and still doing your own thing, but also doing something mm-hmm. More collectively oriented that you get the catalytic effect. Mm-hmm. And so the hope there is that you can build a powerful narrative. You can build new stories. And you can do things that then make those stories come to life. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sort of life, and I think the core of it is really a life-centered approach, particularly to economics, because right now we have a finance-centered approach, solely finance-centered. And
so, do you see efforts that you can point to right now that give you hope, or that can be modeled, or can be something for people to look at, where that coherence is intentional, where the, if it's not scaling, the propagation of
it is, it's like planting seeds,
transformation. Yeah,
they're all going to grow in their own soil and with them.
Yeah, yeah.
Light and water they get, so they're all going to be different. Well, I see Jeremy Lent is one person who I think is doing this type of work. He's now working on the concept of ecological civilization. Mm-hmm. And he's gathered a huge network of folks who are interested in this. And he's playing the role of educating them by having webinars and stuff. Humanistic group does it too. Mm-hmm. So it's bringing people together in new ways. Now, I don't think just doing that on webinars is enough. You need to actually get them working together on some set of shared aspirations and how you build out that. The IPBIS group is working on some papers that have come out of our assessment that are really trying to align things in a different way. Another group I have been working with is called GAIN, the Global Assessment for New Economics. We just had our paper finally accepted into Nature Sustainability. Now, mm-hmm. you know, and it talks about 10 principles that are out there already in wide array of alternative economic framings. So I guess for me, the one thing, and you've also written about this, the thing we really need to change is how we understand the economy and economics as part of societies, as part of the natural environment, not as dominant over them. And the stories we tell us about what those economies are supposed to be doing and how they operate. And that, so I'm seeing bubbling up some significant sort of synthesizing, and you know, I'm part of some of that, and sharing of those ideas. Part of it's in the IPBES assessment, but part of it will come now as a result of the IPBES assessment and activity that's been taking place in a lot of other places.
What places do you think are open to this conversation, and what do you see is giving you hope in a way that, like, for young folks or mid-level folks or anybody interested in this conversation, what should we look at? And if you don't see it, what could we conceive of? What could be done? What's sort of
Well,
missing?
I would put around the economics question, which is, I think, fundamental. I would look to the work that we all is doing, and I know that both of us were behind the you in particular foundation of We All, the Well-Being Economy Alliance, in it in the work that it's doing exactly as a transformation catalyst, whether it designates itself as not. And the idea of well-being economics is being adopted in places like Scotland and New Zealand. And the other similar initiative is Kate Raworth's Donut Economics Action Deal, which has which in which Amsterdam, the city of Amsterdam, has adopted the idea of donut economics, and that's kind of spread out. So these are two, in the economics realm, two sort of big initiatives started out as seeds and now have much more reach and much, and I think they're aligned in many ways, so I don't think they're competitive. You know, different ways of framing economics, and people, as people see that you can have a well-being oriented economics, something that stays within the planetary boundaries and gives people the support they need. I think as those things are becoming into reality, and the changes start to happen, then more and more people will hopefully understand and buy into that, those ideas. That's the seed of, those are the kinds of seeds of hope that I think we can look to.
And in some way, yes, we can do better than this, what we're doing right now. At the same time, there's lots of opportunity if you frame it that way. Where do you see the biggest opportunities? And if you can point to any institution shifting, what would be sort of a tipping point for you where you'd see that's the kind of thing that probably will make the propagation speed up?
I'm in the US and I don't see much hope right here in the US at the moment. Although I do see some of our legislators beginning to get the idea that we need to resist what's going on here. But the European Union has been in the front of actually adopting, they'll call it green, or they'll call it other you know, labels, circular economy and things like that. And they're behind pushing actual legislation and actual understanding of the need for this type of systemic change. They're very aware in the Euro in Europe and throughout Europe of climate change in ways that somehow the US has been resistant to. And so, you know, I would look to the EU. I would look to countries, smaller countries like New Zealand. I would look to some of the initiatives in South America around things like Buen Vivir, you know, good living, you know, and similar initiatives. And I would look to a proliferation and an understanding of indigenous wisdom from many, many different cultures, who live in harmony with nature and who are responsible for much of the remaining sort of ecological biodiversity, because their lands are managed holistically. It's not that they don't work the lands. It's that they are managed from a more relational perspective. So I see these ideas coming up in ways now that 10 years ago we just didn't see. It takes the ideas, you know, Thomas Kuhn said that paradigms die one person at a time. Whereas the neoliberal economics, we know it doesn't work. We know it works for some people, the very wealthy, but we know it has not actually helped many of the people at the bottom, despite claims to the contrary. We know that there's a huge growing inequality. And so as more people see alternatives, I think then the possibilities become more realistic. And I think, again, we all in a well-being economy, donut economics, these things provide specific ways of thinking about the alternatives. They provide images, they provide norms, they provide value. So.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm April Hardy, crime victim advocate trained by NOVA, founder of In Case I'm Murdered, and recent recipient of a $12,500 grant for intimate partner homicide prevention work. I've experienced domestic violence from both sides, as the employee whose performance suffered, and as the business owner who absorbed every cost directly. This is the Safe Work Advantage podcast that helps HR professionals and business leaders recognize risk, reduce liability, and protect their people.
So
that's at the real sort of meta level, like changing, transforming the narrative, the metaphors, the paradigm, the stories. Do you see companies that are like giving you hope?
I don't really work at the company level right now. I mean, I was just in Amsterdam at a conference, and I was working with my friend Harry Hummels, who presented this case, and we all know Interface, the company. And we all know because Ray Anderson, the former CEO, had this epiphany and turned the company to do net zero. What you may not know is that they've been working with indigenous populations in Australia, and it took them about 10 years to, according to Harry and his research and a case that he's writing for the Harvard Business School, for them to really understand how indigenous peoples differently deal with nature and to develop an incredibly successful product line out of that interaction and relationship with people. So it's a much more relationally based thing that is very consistent with what we understand of Interface. But it's a big advance in some ways. So, you know, are there lots of companies doing this? I don't think so yet. Are there some companies that are trying to do it? Yeah, I think Stuart Hart has an idea that is about internalizing externalities and getting companies that are not in the public sector in the United States, still controlled by families, or to be part of that, because they can make longer term decisions. They can make decisions for the good of the whole. And so, you know, you do see these initiatives popping up in various places.
Yeah, I mean, it's a collective effort. Otherwise, it will fail, right? It can't be like centralized in many ways.
And it can't be one person's idea. It has to. We all have to come together in some new ways.
Yeah, wonderful. Now, I just looked at your production record, quote unquote. Even just on your Google Scholar, I think the year 2024, you have 25 publications, and then 23 or something. Like, you're incredibly prolific still. And I know, as a scholar, I'm tempted to sort of dismiss some of the scholarships and the work that goes into it, because I don't see the transmission being that effective. But you seem to be, that's maybe your sweet spot. Are there any things that you can share with anybody that's in the field that can sort of learn, that you can share? Like, what's your process? How do you, I don't think you need to motivate yourself, really. Like, yeah, that's what you do, right? But
yeah,
what do you do? How do you do it? And what would you sort of recommend younger scholars do?
Well, for me, it's about passion. I've always been passionate. I love writing, for one thing. I think you have to like writing and be willing to put your ideas out there. So I like, what for me is the cool thing is that when ideas collide and something emerges out of that, and that can happen. That's why I still like going to conferences, because that can happen at conferences. you know, it's happening, frankly, to me less these days than it used to because I'm older now. But that's where the interest is, on the edge.
Mm-hmm.
A mentor once said to me, read outside your field.
Mm-hmm.
So I recommend to junior scholars, read outside, read books, not just
formulaic
for the most part. So read books outside your field where people can really express their ideas and bring those different ideas that you're reading about. So I was reading chaos theory, complexity theory, Fritzhof Capra's work, all of that stuff years ago when it first came out, thinking, what on earth am I reading this stuff for? Why? But now, of course, it's at the center of understanding of how system change actually happens. So my belief is nothing goes to waste. So it's about reading. It's about working with cool people.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily on the writing, but in the engagement and the ideas. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I probably would say about half my work is collaborative and half of it's probably not.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't actually measured that, but I like working by myself, but I also sometimes you need the stimulation of working with other people who have different ideas. So, and I don't think I really published 25 things. I mean, some of that is conference presentations and stuff. So, going to conferences, working on something that someone invites you to that's different. And then say, how can I develop this further? The latest thinking, it came right out of the Ipsos assessment for me in the reading I was doing for that, is this idea of eco-social imaginaries, framings.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have social imaginaries, which put humans at the center of things.
Mm-hmm.
What if we really sort of turn that kind of upside down and recognize that, hey, we're all interdependent with nature. And the UN has started, and others, has started talking about these eco-social imaginaries. So for me, that's, you could reframe, and I've got a paper that's been rejected once already, on doing that with strategy. What if strategy is stuck? The field of strategy is stuck in a very linear, non-systemic approach, even though strategy ought to be the most systemic of the disciplines we have.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a recent debate going on that a few colleagues, not me, but a few colleagues were involved in that just showed how stuck strategy is. And so I just said, whoa, what would it take? What would it take to transform strategic thinking?
Mm-hmm.
And the key is you have to really think at the systems level.
Mm-hmm.
You can't think at the one firm level.
Mm-hmm.
Companies, like I said earlier, companies respond to the pressures on them. You know, as long as it's pressure for financial performance, then strategy is all about competitive advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And, it has nothing to do with welfare or well-being. So you got to shift that perspective. And I don't know how you do that because it's a huge field of embedded
stuff. Right. So one question, I mean, just in response to what you're saying in terms of the system level, I think, at least for me, system level can be so amorphous and so out there that it's almost spiritual or something that it's difficult to teach and to get people to understand on a cognitive level, possibly. And I oftentimes go back to just individual, not individual as separate from, but as the human being that we are, as part of nature. And I think there is this distinction oftentimes that others are making where it's like, yeah, if you're human-centric, you mean you're human above everything else. But if it's human-centric in a way, it's also like it's from wherever you are into understanding a web of connectedness. So the understanding or the lever is still going to be with your understanding, your doing, your being. And if that transforms, it has these ripple effects outside. What's your response to that? Because
I've been struggling with that for years.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other new initiatives that's come about lately is this IDGs, the Inner Development Goals.
Mm-hmm.
Which are meant to relate to the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals. I have slowly sort of aligned with the idea that, yes, you need to change mindsets, individual mindsets, so that people are more aware. There's a lot of research on this, actually.
Yeah.
And but that's not enough. the mindset has to be, I'm going to work with you, Michael. And I'm, like I said, I'm going to take off my ego hat. And I'm not going to care whether it's my specific idea that gets implemented or not, but it's some sort of something that happens when we come together in a new way that gets, and for that, you do need different ways of being in the world. You do, there is a spiritual element to it. You know, and it's about seeing yourself and humans as part of nature, not as dominant over or from nature, and seeing our institutions, our companies, and our governments and our civil society organizations as part of nature, you know, and as dependent, interdependent, and dependent on them, on the rest of nature, and seeing other beings as having their own agency and their own their own way of thinking. And this has all happened for me within the last few years. This sort of different way of seeing the world in that way. So I mean,
seeing.
How, as a scholar, how do you keep yourself alive? You have to constantly be absorbing new stuff and thinking things and being willing to change your mind. So, you know, I look at my 1997 paper that made me sort of quote unquote famous to the extent that I was, the one that was the social financial performance. I think that's, I tell people not to do that research. It's not where we need to go. So
you still get people, contacting you because of that paper and wanting, it's still
periodically I'll get someone tell me about the methodology. And of course, Sam was the methods person, you know, and it's like, why are you still doing this research? There are literally thousands of papers. There have been meta studies that show papers. We don't need any more. The evidence is there. Yes, there's a positive relationship in general, and it's not making a difference. Because CSR is usually an add-on. Corporate social responsibility is an add-on. It's not about the business model, which is where the impacts are.
Right. So just going back to your career, your contribution, and I think you have embraced, I believe, sort of a healing role through the intellectual work that you're doing, being an intellectual shaman yourself and contributing in that way, doing the work for yourself also on a spiritual level, personal level, but then also bringing those ideas to the field. What would you recommend to younger scholars or people that may not necessarily think that scholarship is going to be their path? What would you recommend are the beautiful opportunities of being a professor, a scholar, in academia? What is the privilege for you in that space?
So it's such a privilege. I mean, we were in this meeting, this conference last week and saying, wow, you know, we get to be here with all these great colleagues. So there is that. There's, for me, it's always been about ideas and what's the next new idea and how can I learn about that idea? So it's ongoing understanding that a scholar, unless you're playing it as a game and getting A hits and viewing it that way, which I think is totally destructive of intellectual curiosity. So the shamans were, the intellectual shamans were curious. They were risk takers. They are. Risk takers, they're curious. They are constantly growing and evolving. They don't sort of sit on their laurels and say, oh, well, I did this paper, so I must be the expert on it. They understand that there's always something more to learn, and they're willing to take the risks and the chances. And they're willing not to play it as a game, but to really believe that ideas matter in the world. And that, I guess, is my fundamental belief. Ideas. And if you don't, If you tap into the ideas that are emerging and evolving, then you're at the exciting edge of where those ideas can begin to make a difference. Now, it doesn't happen instantaneously. Narratives take time to change and ideas take time to sort of penetrate. But over time, things have shifted. I mean, the whole idea of corporate responsibility, when I started, people would say to me, what are you studying? Why are you studying that? And, you know, and now it's just an accepted fact of life that companies have these CSR programs. Well, now we're also saying companies need to be part of the solution. You know, look at David Cooper Writer's work on a business as an agent of world benefit. You know, that starts a whole new conversation What is the role businesses are playing? So like I said, you see this stuff popping up a lot of places. The idea is to bring it all together in some new ways.
And so what has guided you and given you hope? And I think you've said that you've looked out to other people, you've gotten ideas, you've seen basically the power of ideas and experienced it. And I think just by you speaking about these ideas, you've also become more alive. I feel it's like that's where the joy is. And that's where the regenerative power comes for you. Right. And I think for many in the field, as scholars, it's like that, being in that exchange of discovery, inquiry, novelty, and really sort of playing there as rather than sort of like performing.
Playing there, it's not instrumental. One conversation we were having was, you know, it looks like, I don't remember where this conversation was being held, actually. You know, you can play a scholarship as if, I don't know, it was a seminar at BC. You can play scholarship as sort of, okay, I'm just going to do what I need to do to get to. And if you do that, you will burn yourself out. You will not have the ideas or the initiative or the interest in once you get tenure and going forward and trying new stuff. So if you want to be me or someone like me and, you know, well past retirement age and still active, you have to be engaged with the work and the ideas and the where you feel this is making a difference or has at least the potential to make a difference. It's only one little bit. Any of us can only do one little bit.
Right.
But those little bits can add up, you know, if a bunch of people start doing them. So, yeah. So it's about really finding what the core question you want to answer is and then, you know, building a sort of portfolio of things that work around that question. And over time, you just have a body of work.
Yeah. And you what would you do if you were retired?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Sarah Beth Herman, a five-time CEO and host of the podcast No Silver Spoons. This show is for leaders, entrepreneurs, and people building something meaningful without shortcuts. We talk about leadership, mindset, business growth, and the real lessons that come from doing hard things really well. And if you're in the dental industry, you'll hear a few episodes that speak directly to that world too. Because no matter your field, leadership is leadership. Listen to No Silver Spoons wherever you get your podcast.
Yeah, that's a current question, actually, because I am 77, and I don't.
You don't look it, if I may say, right? It's a.
but I would probably keep. I might not do as much of it, but I would probably keep doing pretty much the same thing. I mean, you know, I might as well get paid for it is my feeling.
Well, that's sort of, I think that's where the alignment is, right? It's like if you can find that alignment, ikigai, other people call it, or whatever it is, where you can combine your purpose, your mission, your contribution, and your own sustenance in an integral way, that's what gives life, right? And that's apparently what makes people...
You know, as scholars, we, at least I... am completely identified with my identity as a scholar. And I don't actually know who I would be if I didn't have that basis, I guess. You know, we all have it. I mean, we will have it because you've done the work. I'll take that with you in some ways. But yeah, So I think I would just keep, you know, probably doing pretty much what I'm doing now.
That
the current climate in the U.S., I might switch to more political activism. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, but it sounds like it's still grounded and we can do better than this. And just like, okay, there is something that we can do. And it was the scholarly lens. And that just prompted me because you've shared this also publicly that you're a singer, you're a performer, you're a musician, right? And maybe tell us a little bit towards the end, like what got you into that and what did that do with you embracing music?
So years ago, I was working, 50, 60, 70 hours a week, reading papers and writing and doing all the stuff that we do. my teacher, my shaman, said, you're going to kill yourself.
Mm.
You need to find something else. And so I had started going to back. I always loved folk music, and I had played a little guitar in college, but, you know, life happened and I didn't play much, and I was terrible. I mean, really terrible. And I was a terrible guitar player, but I was a worse singer. And songwriting, nah, I'm never going to do that. There's plenty of great songs already in the world. And then I discovered the Boston area, the Folk Song Society, and started going once a week and playing with folks. I'd never played with people before. And, you know, I now chord better, and, you know, I knew a bunch of songs. And then I discovered this music camp that I started going to, where they teach things like performance and songwriting and guitar and singing. And I started incrementally getting a little better at these things. And I worked at it. I really worked at it. You know, one thing that I think is part of success is discipline. And so, you know, I applied the discipline I'd always applied to my writing to learning how to sing, you know, how to open your mouth, how to get the out. You know, and will I ever be a great singer? No, I don't have the natural ability that some people do, but I'm an adequate singer. And then I thought, and then I took this class from Bob Franke, who was the author of really many beautiful songs. And suddenly I was writing songs. So I've written over 200 songs now. And more. And lately, of course, they've turned to protest songs. So, you know, I have a couple new ones that are protest songs. So, yeah.
What does that do with your being, if I may ask that way? Because, I mean, that's sort of something that's actually, if you like, look system level, quantum, those are things that actually shift our way of being at a level that we're probably not so conscious of. But are you aware of some of the shifts that have happened since you were working with that shaman and that transformation?
Absolutely. I am a much happier person, more confident in myself. It doesn't matter so much to me what other people think about me. Which is why I can do some of the things I do, both singing wise, you know, both songwriting and singing wise, and in academia. And so I had to learn to love myself. And the shamanic practice has helped me to do that in important ways. And I had to learn to relate to other people differently. I am not necessarily a people person, but I had to learn to be able to give love and receive love. And so and you talk about that. Harry Hummels, who you know, that I was talking with last week, he's writing about agape. And that's what our session was on. We were talking, you know, love and scholarship. You know, how do we love our work? How do we bring love to our work? And so that's what we were talking about last weekend. You know, 25 years ago, you would not have caught me doing that. I was miss task, miss straight. None of that stuff was part of my vocabulary. You know,
fantastic.
And the songwriting is part of that, because you get up on the stage, particularly I've done a couple times where I've had someone back me up and without my guitar in front of me. The guitar is like a shield. I play with the shield in front of me, and I don't get so nervous. Boy, take that guitar away and you are naked on the stage emotionally. And, you know, that takes guts. And so I've forced myself to do that a couple of times because I want to take that kind of risk. So.
Well, that's fantastic. That's beautiful. That's really deep and inspiring. And I thank you for sharing that, because I think that's sort of giving us also, to me, grounded hope, you know, that we can
do better than this. I tell younger scholars, find something that really matters to you that isn't work, whether it's hiking in nature or hitting or play music like I do, or I don't know, drumming or whatever it might be, woodworking. Find something that allows you to have that creative outlet in addition to the creative outlet we have as scholars, that we are lucky enough. We are lucky enough to have as scholars and teachers. Because the teaching process, if you're doing an interactive approach to teaching the way I do, that is, you are in the moment, you're creating with your students whatever's going on in that classroom. And well, you better be fully present for that, or it's going to go off the rails very quickly.
Yeah, no, wonderful. Thank you. Now, just to close it off, any number between 1 and 35. And we've played this before, but it's just like...
Oh, I hate these questions. 32.
You hate deep questions, but you were talking about these. Okay. What is it that you most dislike? And what we're doing here for everyone listening is that we're looking at the questionnaire that Marcel Proust gave to his friends. And that is, I think, picked up by some other entities. And so Sandra picked question number 32, which is, what is it that you most dislike? What is that, Sandra?
That's a really hard one, because I try to live in the love rather than the hate. I guess would be something like narrow-mindedness and intransigence and an unwillingness to be open to ideas again. And so, you know, I don't like it when people hurt people. I don't like violence. Mm-hmm. I don't like hatred. I don't like people being mean to each other. I like to live on the opposite side of those things. So,
yeah. You want to do another number, 1 to 35?
You pick one, Michael.
I'll pick one. I'll go to the earlier ones. What is your greatest extravagance?
Probably it was my guitar. So I bought a much, as my, I have two CDs and years ago. And the producer of my CD said, yeah, you don't really deserve this guitar. I'm not sure that could have gone to our player. He was teasing me, but it was definitely an extravagance. And that in music, I go to music camp twice every summer. So, yeah. And I go to all the weekends that they have too. So.
Awesome. That's wonderful. That's inspiring.
Live a very sort of basic life in some ways. I don't like vacationing. I don't like, except in music camp, and I don't like travel for its own sake. And I don't need or want rich stuff, jewelry or anything like that. So,
well, thank you so much, Sandra, for joining. This is just a whole new level of connecting. So,
thank you for asking me. It's very stimulating to have these conversations.
Yeah, no, it's wonderful. It's enlivening, right? It's regenerating.
Absolutely. So, and another person to read, Weber's book, Andreas Weber's book on enlivenment. Great book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, maybe you want to give us a couple other things just to close it off then, in terms of like, what books are you currently recommending for people to check out? And what people do you think folks that are listening should know of that have inspired you and that keep inspiring you?
Well, of course, Peter Senge's book, The Fifth Discipline. Mm-hmm. Anything Fritzof Capra writes, anything. Mm-hmm. I'm currently reading Jonathan Haidt's new book on the on the anxious generation, which is really interesting, actually. And yeah, those would be the people that I would most point to, I think, as people who've inspired me. Anything about systems thinking. So, you know, a lot of the stuff that I recommend to people is where the foundation of my ability to think broader came from. So those are the ones that I tend to recommend. And Robin Wall Kimmerer, her work. She's an indigenous botanist, I guess, but also a systems thinker. My friend Four Arrows, people like that.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Sandra. Reality proves possibility. We can be happier, more alive, and regenerating ourselves and the system in various ways. And
yeah, well, we do our bit.
Yeah. And it trickles through the system.
Hopefully. Okay. All right. Great to see you, Michael.